great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Well, the Energy Information Administration says in 2020, fossil fuels made up about 79% of U.S. energy consumption. But what has the potential to change that figure? Well, fusion energy could. Larry Mueller here again. Thanks for joining us. Talking about the state of fusion energy technology and how to get more women involved in engineering, too. We'll talk about that as well with our guest, Stephanie Deem, as an assistant professor of engineering physics at UW-Madison and energy expert at the Wisconsin Energy Institute as well. So do you think fusion energy is the energy solution of the future? Are you perhaps a woman who works in engineering? How can that workforce attract more women? Hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Or you could send us an email to ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. Stephanie Deem, welcome to the show. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Hi, thank you so much. I'm excited to be here, and thank you so much for inviting me.
Well, I tell you what, fusion energy, I think, you know, a lot of people have heard about fusion energy, but I don't know how many of us really know what it is. Okay, what is fusion energy?
Sure, I can tell you a little bit about what fusion energy is. So fusion, at the heart of it, is fusing two light atoms together. It's basically, fusion is what fuels our sun and our stars. It's what makes them burn. Actually, all the fossil fuels we burn today are created from light from fusion. So every atom heavier than hydrogen in, you know, in your body, in the universe, was created by this process of fusing two light atoms together. So it impacts our daily lives. What is very interesting about fusion is to get those atoms, those light isotopes, to stick together, you have to heat them up to really high temperatures. In the center of the sun, it's like 10 million degrees, right? That's really hot. But to do it here on Earth, because the sun uses gravity, we don't have gravity at that level like the sun does here on Earth. So we have to heat up the fuel for fusion to 100 to 200 million degrees, 10 times hotter than the sun, which means we have to be really creative about how we do that. One way you can do this is you can use lasers to focus laser energy to get to heat those particles up, to get them to stick together, to release a lot of energy. What I do in my research is we make magnetic bottles, essentially, to hold the fuel together so it's not touching any materials. And we call those, you might hear these in the news, tokamaks. They're magnetic bottles to hold the fuel for fusion together. It's pretty amazing. It's a complex grand challenge to hold something at that high temperatures with using magnets. It's kind of like if you're going to confine jelly with rubber bands. Complex, well, fascinating problem.
Well, when I think about magnetic bottles, I think of they don't look like a bottle of Pepsi or beer or something that you kind of put in there.
Right. In this case, we make these bottles that look like donuts.
You make bottles that look like donuts?
Yeah, that's kind of like the shape that we have, these magnetic bottles called tokamaks. They're in a donut shape, actually.
And what do those donuts do then?
Then you can hold the fuel together. There's kind of three things we're worried about when you create the conditions for fusion here on Earth. You want to have enough particles, so density, so that they'll stick together. You have to have them at high enough temperatures, so I mentioned like 100 million degrees, so they can overcome the natural repulsion of nuclei. So that's high temperatures. And then you need to hold on to those particles long enough so they can actually have those fusion reactions happen. So that's time. So that's our figure of merit. We have to have enough particles at a high enough temperature and hold on to them for a long enough time that they can fuse together and release a lot of energy.
So I'm thinking right now off the top of my head and thinking, well, how much energy does it take to produce that amount of heat. And it's, are we, is it, as it's not a zero sum game, I guess, but.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely not a zero. Well, I mean, eventually the goal is, if you're going to harness the, you know, power of fusion to power our cities, you need to release more energy than you put into the reaction. So this kind of all goes back to Einstein's equation. I think people see it a lot. E equals mc squared.
Mm-hmm.
So what that equation boils down to is energy is equal to mass times the speed of light squared. That's what those individual parts mean. So if you weigh the products, those light isotopes, before they fuse together, and you compare to the weight of them after the reaction, there's actually, you lose some mass. And that, through Einstein's equation, means we convert that small amount of mass that's lost when we fuse particles together into a ton of energy, and massive amounts of energy.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's kind of what we're working towards.
Well, you know, somebody might say, sounds like a small amount, but that's little 3%. But how do you harness it then to make it available?
Right. Great question. So I talked about how you can, you know, combine light atoms together, and ultimately what we do is we're combining hydrogen to form helium, releasing a lot of energy in the form of heat. So you use, like our regular power plants right now, when we're burning fossil fuels, we're creating heat to turn turbines, to run generators, to generate electricity. So that's what we're doing for fusion. It's a more environmentally clean energy way to create heat. And what's great about fusion, if you're going to compare it to something like coal, is how energy dense it is. So if you take, I mentioned we use light isotopes of hydrogen. Mm-hmm. So if you take, I'm going to look at the amount of energy release that you need for your lifetime. So let's say to power your car, to power your house, every electronic that you own. If you look at the fuel equivalent for fusion, you take the amount of hydrogen in a bathtub. So that's not very much water, lithium, or not much hydrogen water.
Mm-hmm.
So just one bathtub plus lithium from two laptop batteries that we use to kind of breed some of the fuel that will power your life, your energy for your whole entire lifetime. That is equivalent to burning 230 tons of coal, which produces 380 tons of pollution.
Wow.
So it's a game changer in that sense.
It is indeed. Tom in Green Bay has a comment. Let's go there. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I got a question. If you could talk to about recent fusion that was done in England. They brought it up, the reactor up to fusion point, they shut it down right, and how that's going.
Okay, the fusion energy research going on in England, and you're familiar with that.
Oh, yes. That made headlines last month, right? So in the UK, there is a fusion energy project called the Joint European Torus. And so what's really exciting about that project is it actually used the fuel, deuterium and tritium, those light isotopes that we use for fusion power plants. It actually used that fuel mix, and it produced 590 megajoules of fusion power. So this far exceeded the previous record for fusion energy produced, three times the previous record. And that was super exciting. The reason why people talk about how it produced the most amount of power from fusion, but what kind of didn't come out in the news, which is also super exciting, is that it removed any doubts that we will have problems when we go to run these in fusion reactors. So infusion power plants. So currently a lot of experiments we run with walls of our containers that are made out of carbon because it's easier to run in that situation. But if you're going to run in a fusion power plant, you're going to have metal walls just because they last longer. And so this experiment, when they first ran these fusion experiments with deuterium, tritium, they had pretty poor performance in the metal walls, but we were able to understand through experimentation and models and improve the performance to get these record-breaking energy yields in this case. And it really gives us confidence that fusion will work on our planet and on our planet. And we also have another fusion experiment coming out on the horizon, which is ITER. It's being built right now, and that JET experiment was kind of the proof of principle for ITER, which will be the first experiment that has ever been designed to produce more power, to be capable of producing more power out from fusion than you put in to run the experiment. So that was exciting all around. Not only just record-breaking for amount of power produced, but kind of confirming we're on the right path.
Well, and, you know, it. I think, what did it last, 5 seconds or something like that?
Yes.
A short period of time. But if you can do it for 5 seconds, you know.
Yes.
You know, there's going to be, pretty soon you're going to be doing it for an hour.
Exactly. Because ultimately, you're right. We need to have reliable power plants that are running all day, like 24/7.
Yeah. Our guest today, Stephanie Diem, an assistant professor of engineering physics at UW-Madison, also an energy expert at the Wisconsin Energy Institute. You can join in, too, with your questions. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to ideas@WPR.org. Vern from Eau Claire, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Vern.
Yeah, I got to make it quick. So one source you look at is National Geographic, February 1981. So the Tomahawk donut she's talking about, that was invented by the Russians in 1949. So they have the most advanced mathematical theories on this. But the best reactor to build is the nuclear breeder reactor. You can use thorium, but it's better to use spent fuel because we have 700 years worth stored in Paducah, Kentucky. And it generates 70 times more power than a conventional nuclear fission reactor. And it generates about 90% less waste.
Thanks for calling, Vern. Appreciate it. Stephanie, comment.
Yeah, I think that's a great point that, you know, you bring up that there's a lot of advantages for a lot of different ways we're diversifying our energy sources. So you brought up fission, which is a different reaction. It's breaking heavy nuclei apart, which reduces produces a lot of energy, and there's ways you can refine that. Fusion is actually produces 4 times more power out than a fission reaction, and it doesn't have any pollution, too. So it really kind of speaks to diversifying our broader energy portfolio. So fusion can provide baseload power, you know, works in complementary with other aspects of how we get our energy, like fission, and we can improve those reactors, too. And then it works really well with renewable energy, too. So really diversifying our energy portfolio. And the other thing that fusion brings you is nuclear is energy security. So isotopes of hydrogen are available everywhere. So it's really kind of an equitable energy source, too.
Stephanie Diem, our guest today. You can join in, too. Again, the number is 1-800-642-1234 or email to ideas@WPR.org. Courtney Everett, our producer today. Tyler Ditter, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Talking today about fusion energy with our guest, Stephanie Diem, assistant professor of engineering physics at UW-Madison and an energy expert at the Wisconsin Energy Institute. I'm Larry Mueller. Questions join in at 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@WPR.org. So fusion and fission, they're close in terms of the spelling and everything else, but what are the safety risks of one versus the other?
Right. So fission, you're breaking apart heavy, unstable atoms, and it's releasing a lot of energy. And I think so some of the environmental impacts are long-lived radioactive waste. So fusion is very different. We take light isotopes, they're stable, and we stick them together. The outcome from that is helium, which is safe for the environment, and an energetic neutron, which gives us a lot of heat. That does bring risks with it when we have a neutron. It can cause radiation damage. So some of the risks that you have for fusion, and that's really what we're kind of on the cusp of working on right now as we work towards commercializing it, is looking at how can we have new materials or advanced materials that are less susceptible to neutron damage or neutron radiation damage. So any radioactive waste from fusion is going to be very short-lived, and it's going to be confined to your experiment. So it's just going to stay local. The other safety concern that you have to worry about is tritium. Tritium is a light isotope of hydrogen. It is radioactive, and we have to make sure it's safely contained. So there are companies that are kind of, there are people that are working on safe handling of tritium. We talked about that experiment called JET in the UK that ran with tritium. It has been running, it has run several campaigns very safely with tritium. So has a device in Princeton, New Jersey, has also safely run with tritium. But we need more experience with that, just to make sure we have all safety considerations under control. And then environmental concerns, it's really very minimal because there's very low level activation of waste. Those are the main risks kind of that are associated with it. And that's really what we need to work on when we engage with communities, kind of understand really what they're concerned about too, and making sure that we're addressing that and developing that dialogue now is a great way to make sure that everyone, we can hear everyone and address their concerns.
Mm-hmm. We have Jim and DeForest up next. Hi, Jim. Thanks for calling. Jim, are
yes?
You? Hi, what's on your mind today?
Hello?
Hi.
Hello?
We're not hearing Jim, or he's not hearing us. Let's go to Jennifer in Madison. Jennifer, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. How are you?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Hey, I'm just wondering, when you talk about nuclear energy and you talk about the fission versus fusion and what we have now and the building materials needed to create the environments for these things, you know, that's not hugely sustainable either. And I wonder, of those three that we have existing now, which she feels is the most sustainable?
So, yeah, you bring up a great concern, is making sure that whatever energy that we deploy is sustainable, so we're not continuously replacing components or things like that. That's kind of really what we need to do next in fusion energy, and that's kind of where our field is going, actually, and we have support by the government and our funding agency to look into this, is to making sure that we're doing the best that we can to develop and understand these new materials. The other thing that we do is we design exhaust systems for our fusion power plants, and that's another thing we need to make sure that we're doing a great job of extracting the heat and all the extra particles, the ash. It kind of works like a tailpipe in your car. So that's another avenue we're going to work on so that we're safely making these materials that can withstand neutron damage, and we're reducing the heat loads by making, by understanding the most effective way to extract the exhaust and for the heat. Yeah.
Jennifer, thank you. Appreciate it. Jim and DeForest, on to you now. Hi, Jim.
Yes. Hello. How you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
I appreciate the show, and what's on my mind is I wonder if the professor could update us on where Lawrence Livermore is with their attempt to get fusion using lasers, and if she would explain to people a little bit about that, that there are other methods in which people are trying to get fusion other than tokamaks. And I'll take the answer on the air, if I could, please.
Okay, thank you so much for that, because like you, I mentioned in the beginning, I work on magnetic, but you brought up lasers. So at Lawrence Livermore National Lab, they have an experiment called the National Ignition Facility, and that was a huge milestone that they reached last year. We had a couple big ones. That was one of them where they're focusing a lot of laser energy on a very small capsule that has the same fuel for fusion that we use for most experiments. And they were able to, for the first time, focus enough laser energy to heat up the fuel so they could get this amazing conditions we call a burning plasma, where the fuel is self-heating itself. It's actually heating itself with fusion energy. And that was fascinating. That was never done before, and they were able to achieve that on NIF at Lawrence Livermore. So thank you so much for bringing that up. So, yeah, we've had a lot of great advances, both JET and at NIF, pushing us towards this commercial fusion energy.
Let's take another call. Pat in Three Lakes, your turn. Hi, Pat.
Yeah, this is. I'm not a scientist, and I think I flunked physics in high school. So anyway, it seems my question would be kind of a practical one. Are you trying to create steam power? I know you can't create internal combustion with that. So it would probably have to be steam power. And so if you are trying to create steam power, would it be then converted into electric?
Yes.
If it does,
yeah.
The grid set up, right?
Yeah, that is an excellent question. You are exactly right. Yeah. So what we're doing is one of the byproducts of fusion is a neutron that's moves very fast, which means you can slow it down and it'll start heating up materials. And you can use a heat exchanger then to generate steam to turn turbines. So that's one of the things that we are next on our plate to start working on, is the challenges that come into play when we're optimizing that steam process. So fusion power plants will have what we call a blanket around them. It's a material that will actually capture the energy from these neutrons that are created from fusion energy, and it'll extract through a heat exchanger that heat from that neutron. So thank you so much for that question. You're exactly right, yes.
Pat, thank you so much. Appreciate your call. Let's go to Ben in Madison next. Hi, Ben. Thank you for calling.
I had a couple of questions. One is, in the current nuclear reactors, one of the problems is the waste products. And the half-life is so long, you've got a storage problem is a very big problem. How is it handled in case there is any waste product here? If so, how is it handled? And second question is, in case there is an accident in the what we call current PS reactor, I don't know what you call this, what is the procedures to be careful about in case there is an accident?
Yep.
Okay.
Great. Yeah, those are both really important questions. So thank you for bringing those up. So there is waste produced. It's going to be a low-level radioactive waste. So instead of radioactive, it's going to only be a very short half-life, so 100 years or something like that. That can all be stored on-site. And we are working right now on developing those advanced materials to kind of minimize the amount of waste that we produce, because it's only going to be contained on-site, very small amount. And that will be regulated by the NRC. So they're working right now with scientists and researchers and companies to make sure that we minimize that waste and we are very well adapted storing it and containing it. The other question that you asked is, what happens if there's an accident? And I'm so glad you brought that up. So what happens, like, let's say we lose power to our fusion power plant, and then I mentioned we use magnets to hold it, you know, make this magnetic bottle to confine the fuel for fusion. What happens if those magnets go out? Nothing really happens. That's what's great. Because if you don't have the magnetic bottle to hold on to the fuel for fusion, what happens is everything cools down and it turns into gas. So just like we have around us, it recombines. You do have to worry about there's ways that you can kind of slowly bring that down. And that's like we have ways of like slowly cooling it down. We have ways that actually I've studied is you put in shattered pellets of like ice fuel. So it kind of cools it down slowly. But the worst case, if anything just stops, it just may damage. You might get some heat on the edge of your inside of your vessel, and then you'll have to, you know, change out part of it. So that's one thing that we're actively researching, the best ways to kind of slow it down, but really ultimately just turns back into gas because it cools down.
Ben, thank you very much. Tom and Cable, on to you now. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Larry. How are you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Thanks. Just a couple of things. First of all, the professor could correct me if I don't understand this, but I was under the impression that on planet Earth, we kind of have a, I don't know if you'd call it a shortage, or there's, helium isn't abundant, I guess, let's put it that way. That's one of my understandings. That's one point she could talk about that, because if what I'm understanding she's doing is fusing something together and then you're creating helium. So I'm wondering if indeed there is a lack of helium on our planet, is that helpful to us to create more helium? Because I think it would be cool to have Zeppelins floating around and then traveling by that. So that's one thing. Second thing is cold fusion a myth? We don't hear much about that anymore. And of course, she's talking about great heat. But for a while, a few years back, it seems like we heard all this stuff about cold fusion and that it was a myth. And then I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Thanks, Tom. Appreciate it.
Okay. Great questions. Great points to bring up, too. Yes, we do have a helium shortage. I actually got an email from the university because we use, you know, we use helium to cool things, saying we have a problem. We don't have that much helium, so get your requests in now. So, yes, fusion can help with the helium shortage. We will create helium, so that is helpful. Cold fusion, yes. I'm glad you brought that up too. Cold fusion, if people aren't familiar with it, it's cold fusion is the idea that you can have fusion happen at more like room temperatures or, you know, temperatures way less than 100 million degrees. There were experiments in the early 2000s claiming that they had successfully achieved cold fusion. Sometimes it's called, if you look it up, like bubble fusion or sonoluminescence fusion, where you're basically kind of imploding bubbles in a liquid substrate, and that's creating conditions for fusion. It actually, when the researchers went back to reperform those experiments, they were proven false. So really, you have to get these conditions for fusion here on Earth at the higher temperatures. Physics, unfortunately, doesn't work that way to get it done at the cool temperatures.
Dennis, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Oh, actually, Dennis in Afton, Minnesota is with us. Let's go there. Hi, Dennis.
Oh, yeah. Hi, everybody. Thanks for the show. I appreciate it. It's a topic that needs to be given attention before it really calls for attention, I do believe. Anyway, fusion seems to be something that we're not going to do in our backyard. So, again, it'll probably be in under control of the big guys, and we'll all pay a price, whatever. But as you said, hydrogen is everywhere. So why not do what Alice Chalmer was doing in the 50s? You take the hydrogen, you use solar energy, you get the hydrogen, you run your tractors. You know, we can do that in our backyard. And adding on what they said about helium, the concern there, how much of that are we going to get? You know, this could be some serious humor here. You're aware helium is called a laughing gas.
Yeah.
Yeah, or we all run around. Is it the one where you run around sounding like Donald Duck or something?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yes, you bring up great points. So fusion should be part of a broader energy portfolio? Because you, as you mentioned, some markets, if it, you're going to, you know, just create energy for your house or your equipment, you may not need a baseload power of fusion, and that's why it works really great in the broader sense of complementing something like renewables or something like hydrogen economy, and it works great for things like industry. So if you're going to have a lot of industrial processes, they require a long a baseload power source that's on 24/7, so it can kind of help fill in those gaps. And really, you speak to what we need to do in the U.S. is we need to work with local communities, and we need to learn from them on what they want, and kind of get those dialogues going now. So we make sure that if fusion's right for your community, great, or we can solve it with other forms. We have We're in an exciting time right now where we have a lot of different choices. I can't remember the other. Was there another question?
No, I think that was
it. Okay.
Well, I was worried that it would, I guess that fusion sounds like, he said, sounds like something the big guys would get in, run it, and then charge us an arm and a leg for.
Yeah. Okay. So then you come down to price, right? It really, markets drive energy choices right now. So we in our community kind of came together and said, if we're going to commercialize fusion, it's going to be for everyone, and it's going to be at a price point that people will want. So while we're developing this, we need to keep that in mind and continuously talk to people. And the other thing that means is if people want to give us the input and they want to help out with fusion, they can join the fusion workforce because, I'm a scientist, but we have people with all different backgrounds that kind of contribute to this rich, diverse workforce, because fusion is kind of everything from welding, project planning, building. We're building intricate structures, so that's an art form in of itself, and a lot of different engineers and project people. And so one of the things that I do is I started with my colleagues, usfusionenergy.org website. So if people are looking with any kind of background or any kind of skill for a job in fusion, you can join us, and you can look for jobs on our website too.
And what's the website again?
It's usfusionenergy.org.
usfusionenergy.org. Okay.
Yep.
To go along with Mickey of Viroqua wondered, you know, is it possible to make small-scale fusion available at the consumer level, for example, rather than electric vehicles that need to be recharged and have limited driving distances? Would a small fusion engine be possible that could go further and, you know, be even more useful for the average person?
Yeah, that's a cool concept. It kind of reminds me of Mr. Fusion from Back to the Future, right? That would be amazing. I think at this point we're focused on the larger baseload power, so like powering a few homes or a city or towns, because you have to, like I mentioned, you have to reach those high temperatures. So you kind of it basically means you're building for larger devices too, not something that fits on your car.
Kurt in Chippewa Falls, your turn. Hi, Kurt.
Okay, thank you. And I apologize for having such a basic physics 101 question, but I can never remember what's the difference between an element, basic element, and the isotope of that element, and what makes them different, and why are they used in physics and chemical and nuclear experiments rather than the element itself?
Mm-hmm.
What is an isotope, in other words?
Okay, yes. An isotope means it just has the nucleus of the atom has different number, like one less or two less neutrons. So it weighs different. Basically, it weighs different. Yeah.
And so the difference in weight is a reason why it gets used?
Yeah, so really when you look at the temperatures that you need to fuse two nuclei together, it happens at lower temperatures for the isotopes than it does for just a regular hydrogen. Yeah.
And, you know, we've talked about women. You mentioned just sort of in passing, you know, your own role as you're a woman in this field. How do we make the energy workforce attract more women, or how can it?
That is a question that a lot of people are working on, especially in our field, too, because and it's not just women. It's historically marginalized people, too, where there's not very many in our field. So this is reaching out to the broader communities, engaging with them, seeing if they're interested in joining our workforce. So I've done things like I've designed workshops for local schools. So we're kind of teaching people at lower levels in high school or grade school about what we do and getting them excited about Fusion and the work that we do. And representation matters, too. So seeing someone that looks like them or that they can relate to makes them kind of envision themselves in that field, too. So I do outreach through the U.S. Fusion outreach team, actually. It's a grassroots team. So a lot of what we do is talking to the public, doing workshops for kids. Some of it's also retention, so having mentoring available to people, and really providing hands-on experiments for schools as well. And then at UW-Madison, one of our graduate students she won a grant to start a group that supports women and gender minorities in our field, too. So it's a lot of different things going on. It's improving our climate and our culture in our field, and then reaching out to people and engaging with them and seeing what they're interested in. And we have a lot of exciting jobs, too, like I mentioned. Well, we do a lot of cool stuff, yeah.
You're a very engaging person. It's going to be a lot. I hope we have a chance to talk again, if you'll agree to be with us once more.
Definitely.
And again, where's that? What's your website for, you know, people looking for jobs in this area?
Yes. So usfusionenergy.org. They're going to be all over the U.S. too, not just this area. Yeah.
usfusionenergy.org.
Yes.
Stephanie, it has been a pleasure talking with you, and I'm looking forward to our next visit. Thank you so much.
Me too. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Stephanie Deem is an assistant professor of engineering physics at UW-Madison, also an energy expert at the Wisconsin Energy Institute. And you hear the excitement in her voice. She's kind of, I guess, the best of what we have, and it was fun to bring her to the microphone today to talk with you about fusion energy, and we'll have her back, and we'll do it again. But first, have you ever thought about becoming a volunteer weather observer? That's one of the things we'll be talking about next with our weather guys and one other guest as well. I'm Larry Mueller.